So as Andrea said yesterday, for these days of the retreat, we are planning to give talks on the Four Noble Truths. And yesterday she gave an overview. And so it's my task today to go into a little bit more depth with the first of the Noble Truths. And many people find the first one particularly challenging because it's the truth of suffering, and it's challenging because it's counterintuitive that we should pay attention to suffering with any great care and detail. We should turn towards it. Most people's instinct is to turn away from it, and so there's often resistance or questioning, and often doubt can arise when in meeting suffering. There can be a lot of doubt in hearing the teachings to understand your suffering, pay attention to it. A lot of doubt can arise. So it's an important topic to explore. As Andrea said yesterday, after the Buddha attained his awakening, he went off to find his five companions to teach them. And the first teachings he gave them was the teachings on the Four Noble Truths. One of the things I think is significant about the Buddha going off to find his companions, the first people he was going to teach, was they weren't just down the block. They weren't like just stroll down the street and find his friends. They were 150 miles away. And the only way that the Buddha could get there was to walk. And I don't know how fast a mendicant, probably barefoot, can walk across the plains of India. If the traditional chronology is to be believed, it was during the monsoon season that he walked. So I don't know how quickly a mendicant can walk. Mendicant is someone who has to also... It doesn't carry food, has to stop and, you know, beg for food in a sense. And so, you know, I would imagine it took him at least 2 weeks. My guess may be more like a month if he walked. He walked a whole month, 150 miles, in order to convey this teaching to someone he felt that could learn it. That took a lot of commitment. It took a lot of dedication. It took a lot of some understanding. This is really important, and that it was important to convey this to his friends. You don't find a lot of instances in the suttas that demonstrates kind of so actively the Buddha's care, concern, his activity of actually making this tremendous effort to reach out to someone else. And when he finally came, he made that journey, I'd imagine it was pretty consequential what he had to teach, what he wanted to teach. And what he taught was the Four Noble Truths. In fact, what the Buddha said in a number of places is that the teachings that are special to the Buddha, that what's really special to him compared to the other teachings of the time. The Buddha adopted teachings from his environment. Not everything the Buddha taught was original to him. But what was original to the Buddha was the Four Noble Truths. That's really the heart of it. It's said that all of Buddhism follows in the wake of the Four Noble Truths, or all of Buddhism can be contained in the Four Noble Truths. In a way, the insight that led to the Four Noble Truths is what transformed the Buddha. And that transformation, it was a transformation that led him to want to go these 150 miles to teach transformation to his friends, something that would transform them, to change them. And as Andrea said yesterday, the Four Noble Truths are connected to actions, behavior, things we do with them. It's not just a matter of believing them and saying, oh, what a great idea they are. But they call there's a task associated with each of the Four Noble Truths. And it's a tasks that are ennobling. And in fact, some people have translated the Four Noble Truths as the Four Ennobling Truths, because of they're not meant to be propositions, but rather activities of transformation, of change, of moving towards freedom. And that change, that transformation, that movement towards freedom, sometimes it's been called ennobling, becoming a noble person. And it's an expression that implies to me a certain degree of dignity, uprightness, of worthiness, worthfulness. Something that holds the human being, holds each of us in great esteem and value, that we have this possibility, this value, this possibility of this transformation, of change. If the Buddha had been Mr. Natural, some of you remember Crumbs, Mr. Natural? He never would have left Buddhagaya, never would have left the Bodhi tree. He would have just sat there and civilizations would have come and gone. But there's a kind of, I see in Buddhism a very deep kind of respect and honoring and valuing of each individual person, the worth of a person, and offering a teaching that is ennobling. And so the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, suffering by itself is not ennobling. And there are traditions where I've heard where you're kind of expected to suffer, that suffering's good, and the more you suffer, the better. And heaven forbid that you have joy and happiness. The Buddhist tradition doesn't hold suffering up as a virtue. In fact, becoming free of suffering is the virtue, is the goal. But if you're going to suffer anyway, if you're going to suffer, then there's a way of engaging in that suffering that's ennobling, a way of engaging that suffering that's freeing, that brings wisdom, understanding. So suffering is not noble, but there's a way of relating to suffering which is ennobling. There's a way of relating to suffering which is valuable and important. And it points to the idea of a relationship. What's the relationship you have? What are the relationship can you have with your life, your experience, and everything? And a lot of life has to do with relationship. And a lot of what's important in life has to do with relationship. For the Buddha to walk 150 miles in the monsoon, it's because he had this relationship with someone that he felt that was somehow, in that relationship, there was a possibility, there was meaning, there was maybe compassion, caring. And so there's a way of relating to suffering, and the difference between ordinary suffering and noble suffering has to do with that relationship. And it's a relationship where we look at suffering to understand it in a deeper way, in order to understand our suffering so we can find the path through it, or find the path with it, that leads to peace, that leads to happiness, that leads to a deeper and more meaningful life. So one of the things that we're asked to do in the Four Noble Truths is to understand our suffering, to spend time getting to know it. And so some years ago, someone had put a whole stack of bumper stickers at IMC that said, I stop for suffering. Because that's what we do in the Four Noble Truths. We stop and willing to look at it. And that's very different than most strategies people have with their suffering. Yesterday, Andrea gave a list of kind of comparable terms or synonyms for suffering. She gave, I don't remember all of them, but she mentioned stress as one of them, distress. Stress works very well as a translation for suffering. Sometimes for the word dukkha, because some of the things that the Buddha said are dukkha, it's a little bit hard to see, well, how is this suffering? But as soon as you add the word stress to it, then, so for example, the Buddha said, birth is suffering. Birth is dukkha. Well, how is that, you know? But birth is stressful. There are things that in our life, in human life, that are considered to be wonderfully happy events that are also among the most stressful people can go through. Like I've been told that getting married, you know, you're supposed to be happy when you get married, right? But I've been told also it's one of the most stressful things people go through. Marriage is stressful. You really don't, you don't want to say marriage is suffering. You don't, usually you don't want to say it out loud. But it can be stressful. The word that I like for, it doesn't work always in all circumstances, the word that I like for dukkha is conflict. That we often find ourselves in conflict. We find ourselves in conflict with other people, we find ourselves in conflict with experiences, we find ourselves in conflict with ourselves. There's psychological conflicts, it's with all our beliefs and stories and ideas of self that are in conflict with themselves. We're in conflict with our emotions and feelings, which can be difficult. We're in conflict with our bodies, our aging bodies. The Buddha said old age, aging is stressful. Aging can be in conflict. We can be in conflict with the aging process. We can be in conflict with so many different things. We can be in conflict with the way things are. We could be in conflict with the way things aren't. We can be in conflict with what we want. We can be in conflict with what we don't want. So one way or other, we're kind of struggling with so many different things. And the Four Noble Truths is a process of insight that hopefully will lead to the end of conflict, the end of struggle. So one of the most common forms of conflict is the conflict having to do with not liking something. I don't like it. Whether it's something as simple as the heat or the cold or an itch or an ache or the food that we have or the circumstances of our life. There's a lot of things which are not inherently suffering in themselves, but the suffering arises when we're in conflict with how it is. We're in conflict with when things happen that we don't want to happen, we don't like to happen, it's very easy to be in conflict with it. When what we want to happen doesn't happen, it's very easy to be in conflict with it. And so we have to understand the nature of conflict. And part of the conflict, the idea of why I like the word conflict, it implies much more directly the idea that we're involved in a relationship to something. To say I'm suffering, you know, you can kind of imagine I'm just suffering. It's the nature of the universe. It's inherent to life. I'm suffering. I don't know why I'm suffering. I'm just suffering. But where, you know, you don't necessarily see the relationship, but with conflict, it's clearer that it's a relationship. So in looking at the relationships that are connected to suffering, and one of the very, I think, important tasks if everyone to do is to study what is your relationship to suffering? What is your relationship to conflict? What is your relationship to discomfort? So put aside for the moment, what the suffering is about, or what the conflict is about, or the discomfort. But how do you relate to those, the presence of it? And I think different people, maybe because of different personality types, or I don't know why, often will have a particular strategies, which is like their common strategy. So some of the strategies of how to deal with unwise ways to deal with suffering. One of the ways is denial or avoidance. So some of you heard about the Charlie Brown cartoon. Charlie and Linus are talking, and Charlie says, "Oh, so you don't something like, oh, my father can, you know, is quite capable to fix anything at all." And just the other day, we were driving in a car, and all this loud clanging sound came from the engine. So Linus says, "Oh, don't tell me. Your father stopped the car and fixed the engine, fixed the problem." And Charlie says, "Oh, no, he turned up the radio." So to distract ourselves from suffering is a strategy. To pretend it's not there is a strategy. To hope other people don't notice it, whatever it might be, is a strategy. Another strategy that some people have is anger, blame. If I'm in conflict, if I'm suffering, someone is responsible. It's not me. And so then we go in kind of an attack mode, get angry at other people, is a fairly common one. When I went to San Quentin on Friday to meet, we went to see a program for the prisoners there called Violence Prevention Program. And they developed a saying, apparently, in that program that something to the effect of, "Hurt people hurt. Healed people heal." So these are people who've caused a lot of harm, so they know what they're talking about. You know, they're qualified, I guess. And you know, so when we feel, some people when they feel hurt, feel discomfort, feel stressed, feel challenged, some people, well, a strategy is to turn that around and hurt someone else in return. Not deal with their own pain, but inflict it somewhere else. So this kind of directing it outwards strategy. Some people's strategy is to direct that that anger inward. And so they attack themselves. They're very critical. All kinds of forms of self-harm that people can do to themselves. Because they haven't developed the capacity to be present for their suffering without being triggered by it, without being reactive to it. And it's so that's another strategy. Another strategy is to look for someone else who's going to be your savior. There's someone or something or some activity, something out there that's going to help me, that's going to take responsibility for me. I can't take responsibility. I've never occurred to me I'm supposed to take responsibility. But someone out there, something out there is going to do it for me. And so there's constant searching for things. And there's a whole, you know, range of things that people search out for the thing that's going to be the solution. Not the direct solution. It's kind of like magical thinking. You know, alcohol. You know, if that'll be the solution. If I could just drink myself to oblivion, or just drink myself, or drugs, or food, or sex, or money, or status, or power, or a lot of friends on Facebook. There's a lot of things, you know, all kinds of things that people reach out for, that, and thinking that's going to, you know, really address this, you know, core suffering that I have. And it's kind of magical thinking. Sometimes it works a little bit, because sometimes you're distracted by these wonderful things if they're successful for a while. But there's many ways in which even successful pursuits, as wonderful as they are to succeed in certain things, they create kind of a shell or a covering over something unresolved inside. And so that sits there, sometimes sits there and festers. Sometimes it just sits there very patient. And it's amazing to me how patient our unresolved issues can sit in our heart and wait for decades. They're just going to sit there and wait until you finally slow down enough, you finally get still enough, or until things start falling apart enough. And then it begins to show itself. So, you know, being distracted, being outwardly focused is an approach. At this point in a retreat, we often give teachings on the five hindrances. For those of you who are new, There are several things that are very important to understand about the five hindrances. These are common states of mind or reactions of the mind which make it very hard to be present. They're kind of you can think of them as centrifugal forces that spin you out, or think of them as black holes that you go into it and you can't get out, like light goes into a black hole and doesn't come out. Very powerful forces of mind pull you into themselves. And it's important to understand these are kind of universal human tendencies, and we're not supposed to take them personally, like a personal failing that you have these. So some of these strong forces, these five strong forces are desire, especially sensual desire, but all kinds of desire, ill will, anger, aversion, in Buddhist English we say sloth and torpor, lethargy and resistance that can happen, and then restlessness and anxiety, restlessness and remorse, and the last one is doubt. And what's interesting about these five hindrances is they can also be seen as strategies of how we react to challenges, when we're challenged. So some people, when they're challenged by things that are uncomfortable, difficult, stressful, they're in conflict with, one strategy is the desire strategy. And people will go into fantasy, daydreaming about some wonderful possibility in the future, some wonderful solace, some wonderful relief. A vacation in Hawaii would be great. Or, you know, all kinds of things people start thinking about. It's a kind of a way of escaping from really, in a noble way, dignified way, showing up for our life, being present. This is what's happening here. Another strategy is the aversion strategy, talked about already, the ill will, the anger, blame. The third strategy is this resistance, you know, or shutting down, giving up, it's, you know, kind of draining of energy. Oh, not again. And it's really fun to see it in a small kid, you know, see a four-year-old kid, you know, just going along merrily, happily, playing, lots of energy, and then say, you know, it's time to take a bath. Oh, I'm too tired. And, you know, the whole shoulders drop, arms drop down to the ankles, and it's like, oh, it's everything so heavy and difficult, and oh, it's too much. How could you do such a horrible thing to me? Let me take a bath. And this is, I can't. I had a bath just last week. And then you get them in the bathtub and they can't get them out. So the lethargy thing, or just kind of giving up. And it's very common for adults. They don't do it so dramatically. We're more subtle, sophisticated. And our hands don't drop as to our ankles. Becoming restless. Some people's response to challenge or suffering is they just don't know what to do. They run around in circles and they just kind of try to do everything, going left and right and up and down, not anything but to sit still and be present. And then the most powerful one is doubt. And this is very common strategy and response, relationship to suffering, to difficulty, to challenges, is to have doubt. To doubt oneself, to doubt, like on retreat, to doubt oneself, to doubt the practice, to doubt the retreat, to doubt the teachers, to doubt the teachings, to doubt, you know, some people have faith in all these things. They go, you know, I could do it, I'm sure. The teachers are good, the teaching is good, the practice is great. But I doubt this was the right time in my life. You know, probably, you know, maybe in about 10 years. Remember Augustine's? Is Augustine saying, give me chastity, but not yet? Give me freedom, but not yet. I'm not ready yet. This is not quite. So all kinds of doubts. And doubt is said to be the most powerful of these strategies, because doubt is the one that can really stop you in your tracks and actually cause you to abandon whatever good endeavors you're trying to do with in your life. So it's, I think it's very important to spend some time looking at the relationship we have with suffering, to understand, because if you have an unhealthy relationship to suffering, you won't be able to approach it with the kind of respect and clarity that's really required to really be present and see it for what it is. And if you don't see what your suffering is, if you can't really see it for what it is, that itself gives rise to all kinds of unhealthy things that happen. For one thing is that if you don't understand your suffering, the nature of it, and really study it well, then you don't understand it. If you don't understand it, it's in the dark. You're in the dark with it. Or as they say in modern psychology, you become unconscious about it. It's a unconscious part of it. And I'm fond of a saying by Carl Jung that said something like, whatever doesn't come to consciousness, whatever, you know, inside what's going on, doesn't come to consciousness, it returns or is seen as fate. And how I understand that is that it's kind of like a magical thinking. When we don't understand what the forces are inside of us, what goes on, then there's all kinds of kind of magical thinking, kind of and magical processes that we things happen to us, and we assign meaning to them. Anyway. But one of the, if we really understand the causes and conditions inside, then we can take responsibility and we see with what's happening, as opposed to thinking it's all magical and magical solutions to our suffering. As Andrea said yesterday, the first of the Eightfold Path steps involves right view, which is having the seeing our experience in the framework of the Four Noble Truths. The path begins, in some formulations of the path, the Eightfold Path, with where you find the path is by understanding suffering, the cause of suffering, and the cessation of suffering. It requires really seeing our suffering carefully. And so to find the path of practice is when we're suffering, when we're in conflict, when we're struggling with something, the path of practice is found by understanding our contribution to that struggle, to that conflict. It doesn't mean that there isn't something to understand out there in the world. It isn't something to be done in the world. We should be wise and live the world wisely. But the path to freedom, spiritual freedom, is found by understanding what our contribution is. Many years ago, I was involved at the San Francisco Zen Center with writing up their ethical guidelines for their community. And I've never seen so much ethical conflict in that community until they started trying to come up with their ethical guidelines. There was something about Zen where they were kind of antinomian, they're kind of like against rules and things like that. So suddenly they came to ethical guidelines and like, we don't do that here. We believe in just freedom. And I don't know what. And so I stepped in and was helping out. And then I was assigned to a committee of people to work out this document. And because it was ethics, every comma was significant. You know, it was all kind of great detail. And so I went to a lot of meetings where there's 3-4 of us in this committee going over the fine details of this ethical document. And sometimes we were in conflict with each other, you know, disagreeing about all that. And it was one wonderful week where I left the meeting, and I was kind of like butting heads with this other man in the committee, like we were seeing eye to eye, and was kind of stressed out a little bit, or a little, you know, conflict about the comma or something like that. And then the next week, the next meeting, as soon as I saw my friend, I said to him, I went up to him and said, "I have to talk to you." And he said, "Oh yeah, I want to talk to you too." And before I could say it, he said what I was going to tell him. He said to me, I want to apologize for my contribution to the stress, the conflict we had in our relationship last week. And that's what I was going to say. Both of us, our instinct or our way was to look at ourselves and to see what we had done to contribute to that, as opposed to staying in the blaming mode of, he's the one. And I want to apologize. You know, this is, you know, I want to apologize for what I contributed here. It's useful interpersonally sometimes to do that way, but it's very useful personally to look at your contribution. And the Four Noble Truths is really the tasks of the Four Noble Truths. At the heart of it is to take responsibility for your contribution to your suffering. It doesn't mean that people don't do terrible things to each other. People have done terrible things to you sometime in your life. It's not to deny that or to justify that or say that they're not responsible for that. But still, even so, how do we pick it up? What do we cling to? And you know, it's very hard somehow to convey the difference or to really point to the contribution we make in suffering, in our suffering, when horrible injustice has been done to us. And in fact, sometimes to say it too adamantly is to put salt in the wound that someone has experienced. So you want to say it the right time and way. But the task of practice is, no matter how horrible the suffering we experience, how horrible we've been treated, the freedom is found by looking and seeing, what are we holding on to? How is our heart closed? What are we resisting? What are we giving up on? What are we... And there's many, many things that we... many things inside that we might be doing in relationship to it. If it's a simple thing, it may be easy to see our contribution. If I say something like, I think that people who wear socks are silly. You know, so my hope is that all of you just kind of lets that go right through. Like, what's he saying? That's not going to stick for very long. But if some of you said reaction is, oh Jesus, this Buddhist teacher has his opinion about people who wear socks. And I'm wearing socks. This is embarrassing. Now everybody's probably looking around the room, seeing who's wearing socks and they're not wearing socks, and they see that I'm wearing socks, and this is rather embarrassing. And it must be not the right etiquette at a Buddhist retreat center to wear socks, and I better rush out. I better take them off, or now I really might as well go home. It's a lost cause to be on this retreat. So hopefully, to take responsibility to see all those thoughts and beliefs operating and all those reactions operating and take responsibility for that. And not spend a lot of time being angry with me for having such strange ideas about socks. Let me have strange ideas. You can later leave me a note and say, Gil, that was inappropriate. That's okay. But the way that you suffered because of it, that's really up to you. What you did with it. So to be able to stop, and first to learn, how do we avoid suffering? How do we relate to it so we don't really face it, is a really important task. And when you feel conflict and feel suffering here in the retreat, you don't have to plunge right into the suffering itself. You might take this opportunity to skirt around the edges of it, to look at, how am I relating to this suffering? Am I afraid of it? Am I angry with it? What's my relationship to it? And you can learn a lot there. And once you kind of get a sense of that relationship and maybe able to settle some of it or see, or understand it well enough it doesn't interfere, maybe then it's time to go in and look at the suffering more carefully for what it actually is. So before we do a little bit of that, I want to spend a little bit more time on the relationship to suffering, the unhealthy ways, or the relationship to suffering we have. One way we're in relationship to our suffering is we will often place it in a story. We have stories we tell ourselves about our suffering. And so it's interesting to look at what are the stories you tell yourself when you're in distress or in conflict or uncomfortable. So, for example, there's a story, one common one might be that if I'm uncomfortable in any kind of way, this means that something is wrong. That's a story. To be uncomfortable, does that mean anything is wrong? It just means that you're uncomfortable. It doesn't have to add anything to it. Or if you're uncomfortable, it means that you're a failure. That somehow, like, you know, people get sick, you know, some people feel like it's a personal failure, they got sick. Or if all kinds of things go on in life and they feel like it's a personal failure. I'm a failure as a person because this didn't work out, or because I'm suffering or feel distressed or feel sad or whatever. It's a story that envelops the suffering we have. There's stories, a lot of stories that are made up where we're the main character in the story. So our self-image, the way that we want to represent ourselves or don't want to represent ourselves. So we feel suffering, and this tells a story about who I am. And the one common story is the story of the victim. I'm a victim. And, you know, in a certain kind of way, people are victims when things are done to them. But we know there's people who latch on and get attached to the identity of being the victim. And they carry it around with them as a badge. I think part of the reason why it's a strategy some people adopt is that if you can be a really good victim, people will treat you accordingly. People will care for you and, you know, cook for you or do all kinds of wonderful things to you. And you can feel safer because people will kind of gather up around you sometimes. That's one reason why. There's the story of that I'm the crusader for justice. It's up to me to right the wrongs and let me get involved there. So it's interesting to ask yourself, what is a story that you have that you add to your suffering? This is unacceptable. If that was one I had. I had a great capacity of avoiding my suffering, denying it, pretending it wasn't there. But if it was there, one of the stories I had was that it was really embarrassing to suffer. And if other people saw that I was suffering, they would judge me as being kind of an inferior person, kind of an inadequate person, an unworthy person. So it was important not to let people know that I was suffering. That's a story that I made up. And some of these stories we live by, you know, maybe had their beginning in some real event. And I know when I was a young kid, you know, a young teen, I would tell some people things about myself, and they didn't hold it very well. I remember the first time, I must have been about 15. I had a 17-year-old friend, and I was walking in the most beautiful alpine mountainous setting you can imagine. Snow-peaked mountains, great blue skies, beautiful green lush valleys below, just beautiful place. And I was looking at the sky, looking at this whole world of ours, and I was just in awe. And I was just kind of like in awe, and I, you know, what's the meaning of all this? What's the meaning of this life? Kind of innocent awe and wonder. And my friend turned to me, he's older, authoritatively, and he said, "Don't be so silly." And he said that, something closed inside of me. I wasn't going to show that to him. I wasn't going to show that part of myself to anyone again. So the story I made up from that one event was that it wasn't safe to show that part of my heart, that kind of wonder, awe, questioning, to someone else, because you know, they'll hurt it again. I've since learned that's not the case. That, and one of the things I've learned, one of the stories that I live by now, is that when I suffer, it's really useful to investigate it. The Four Noble Truths is a story. The Buddha's life is a story that hopefully is pointing to a different way of relating to suffering. Some people say it's a story that leads to the end of stories. But it's still a story. The story that says that to take responsibility for your suffering, it's important to investigate it, to be present for it, to understand it, to enter into it. So one of the challenges to doing that is understanding why is it valuable to turn towards and understand suffering. Isn't it just better to go take a vacation in the beach than to sit here with it all? And there's two primary reasons why I think it's valuable to turn towards suffering. Or maybe three that I'd like to mention. There can be others as well. One important one is that it's true. And there's something very significant about being in touch with what's true. One of my first Zen teachers, when he described his the hook, or what brought him into Zen practice, he was a college student, kind of very very disconnected from himself, out of touch with himself. I think he was in, I don't know if it makes any difference, but he was studying mathematics, which can help keep you at a distance from yourself, I suppose. And he went and was introduced to Zen meditation, and he tried it out, and it was gruelingly painful for him to sit in this Zen posture for 40 minutes. But because he was so disconnected from himself, he said, it was the first time that I was real. And that being real or being true, or just meeting what was really true, was so meaningful for him that he became a Zen practitioner, a Zen priest, now a Zen teacher. That was the hook. Now, I don't wish that doorway for you, but it points to the idea that if we want to be real, if we want to meet reality, meet ourselves in a real way, we have to meet what's there. We don't want to pretend that it's not there. We don't want to avoid what's there, because avoidance doesn't connect it to what's real. And there's something really profound, certainly dignified, noble, about being willing to be present for what is real. And if what is real is suffering, to be present for that. And it's not just being present for it, but learning the capacity to be present for it without all these extra painful second arrows, third arrows, to be present for it in the simplicity of it, without all the other kind of unhealthy relationships we can have. It's a phenomenal process to come to a very simple relationship to suffering. And it's a freeing one, because most suffering that people experience is not the primary suffering, but rather it's all those layers we add on top of it, the relationships we have to it, to some discomfort. So to be real. Another reason to learn to be present for suffering is that there's an inner wisdom. I like to call it inner wisdom. There's an inner unfolding, an inner process that can happen when we're present, that can't happen when we're not present. So there's a lot of, you know, the way human beings are constructed, the way nature is in many ways, there are these almost innate or innate processes that, given a chance, will operate. And so, for example, if if you cut your finger, there is, if everything's working relatively well, there's a very complicated process of healing that cut. If we had to orchestrate, engineer that healing process on our own, direct those, you know, chemicals and bloods and hormones and antibodies and, you know, and proteins, and everything has to be sent down to that wound, we would, you know, probably short circuit. We had to do it, you know, consciously. But there's an amazingly complex physiological process that goes in, that, you know, something knows in our system what to do. What we have to do, our contribution to it, is to keep the wound clean and covered. If we can keep it clean and covered and simple like that, then something knows. So the same thing with the wounds that we carry inside of ourselves, our suffering, our sense of inner conflicts, turmoil, stress, that if we can be present for it in a simple way, not be in conflict with it, not fighting it, not running away from it, just be present, hold it lightly, hold it openly. Learn the art, learn the wonderful skill of being kindly present for your difficulty. Don't be in a hurry to get rid of it. Don't make a story that this means that the retreat's a failure. Just let it be simple. Here it is. And hold it. And then perhaps that's like having the bandage. That's like keeping the wound clean. And then your heart, your inner life, your psychology, more often than not, it knows what to do. It'll process. It'll unfold. It'll allow something to pass through you. You see that it's often psychologists often point this out in relationship to grief. That if you can keep your grief clean, meaning you don't attack it, you don't get angry with it, you don't despair because of it, you don't have a story that you should be over it by now, you're not embarrassed for it, you don't indulge in it, you don't kind of wallow in it, but very simple, open relationship to the grief. You'll go through some various phases. Different processes will go on, will wash through you. Your heart will know what to do. And you'll come to the other end, sooner or later. Very touching, many years ago, when I had worked with a woman on retreat whose teenage daughter had committed suicide. One of the more painful things to have to experience as a mother. And she'd come on retreat with me after she was kind of healed from it all. And come to the other side. And she had been on a retreat, and the first interviews on the retreat was a group interview. We ran around the circle of about 8-9 people. Everyone talking, you know, doing their group interview. And we came to the woman just before her turn. And the woman just before her turn was a deep grief, because her teenage child had just committed suicide. And the coincidence of these two sitting next to them, each other, and the next person to speak was this woman who'd gone through the other side, was too much for me to not do what I did next. I introduced them to each other. I said, "You should meet this woman, and perhaps let her talk to you about her experience." And that was really helpful for the new person on the retreat to know that someone had gone through it. So it's often pointed out with grief that there's this innate process that can go on. We have a role to play, and the most important one is to get out of the way. And that's why understanding our relationship is such a key one, because then we understand how we're interfering. And a big part of mindfulness practice is learning how not to interfere with what's happening. Not interfere by indulging in it, getting involved in it in some too active way, or not interfering by pulling away, or just letting it be. So the first benefit of suffering is it helps us get real. The second benefit is that if we learn how to be present for suffering, we allow something to unfold that maybe has some innate wisdom to it. The third benefit of suffering is that if we study the suffering, if we really spend time looking at it, it takes a while, it takes a lot of patience, but then we can learn from that suffering. We can learn what's going on in that suffering. The suffering becomes a mirror with which we can understand ourselves better. And then we get to a very interesting kind of phenomena that most suffering arises as a way of being in relationship. So we talked about we're in relationship to suffering, that adds suffering to suffering, but also that the suffering we have itself is a way of relating. We relate by pushing things away, resisting things. We relate by not letting things go, holding them tight, grasping with them. We relate by running away. We relate by attacking. We relate by giving up. We relate all kinds of things to what's going on in the world. In the Buddhist language, in Buddhist kind of teaching, all these different ways of relating that give rise to suffering have an element in common. And I like to use the word compulsion for that. There's a compulsivity behind the resistance, the running away, the clasping close, holding tight, all these different things we do. And that's part of the reason why the suffering is really suffering, because it doesn't let up. It doesn't let go of easily. It can follow us for a long time. It can stay there and fester for years and years sometimes, some of them. And so one of the interesting things to study is that nature of that compulsivity, that, or to use a more popular, more modern word, the drivenness. There's a drivenness around the relationship we have. The Buddha used the word thirst for that. There's kind of a thirsting connected to it. But what's the nature of that kind of magnetic or that gravitational pull or that stickiness or that glue that keeps the relationship stuck, keeps it churning away? And that's part of what we study. What is this? What is the nature of this compulsivity, this grasping, this thirsting? And to study suffering, to be present for it, to know how to be present for it in a very calm, relaxed, open way, to trust the inner unfolding, to trust what goes on, even if it feels like it gets worse, to trust that inner process. So we can be still and quiet, simple with it for a long time. So we can begin teasing apart the different elements of it until we, at some point, maybe we can see where the compulsivity is, what's fueling it, what keeps it going, what are the stories, the beliefs, the emotions, to see it well enough, complete enough, that at some point we can let go. At some point we can open the hand, release the hand. So there's value in looking at suffering. And there is greater value in opening the hand. A hand that's kept closed in a fist is useful for only a few things. Many of them which most people don't want you to use it for. But if you open your hand, if you release the fist, your hand can be used for much more. If you open the fist, then the soft, tender part of the hand is available to the world. It's available to you to feel the world. It's available for the world to feel you. If we can let go of the fists in the heart and the fists in the mind, then the more tender, softer, more loving, more helpful parts of you have a chance to come forth into the world. And for the Buddha, he released the fist in his heart, and with that soft, open hand, he walked 150 miles so he could find us and tell us there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's really the possibility of the release of that, the cessation of that, and there's a marvelous way of living this life, a wonderful way of giving expression to this freedom that's found in the Eightfold Path. I very much don't want any of you to suffer. That's my deep heartfelt wish. But I know that if you happen to be suffering anyway, that it's really profound and meaningful to be willing to stop, be still, and give lots of time for this to be there, show itself, and get to know it. Not so you suffer better, but so that you can find a path to happiness and peace. And I hope that on this retreat, that at the very minimum, that you feel happy knowing that you found a path that has such a good aim. It's a wonderful thing to be doing. So thank you, and let's sit quietly and for a minute or so and let these words and feelings that arose, let them settle in. Part of the inspiration for this talk today was a knowing of a friend of mine who has said that she trusts suffering.